Well, first of all, thank you all for coming tonight. It's a great pleasure to speak to you here in Beijing. It's not my first trip to Beijing, but it's certainly my first trip that's involved in an alumni visit. I was delighted on arriving in the room to see that my colleague from the Department of Statistics is the real celebrity of tonight's event, but I will do my best despite that. Brendan says rightly that my background is primarily as a scholar and teacher in political theory, but tonight I'm going to talk, hopefully not too great length, about the UK government, the UK coalition government from 2010, and its relationship with Europe, because I thought that might be something that is of interest. Some of the story that I'm going to tell has a historical dimension, and I think some of that is particularly pertinent now, because we have this week heard the news of the death of Mrs. Thatcher, the significant, possibly the most significant post-war British political figure in terms of her impact, her global impact. Whether history will confirm that judgment is a very interesting question. Some of what I'll say might suggest that her standing is something that might be slightly revised in relation to the historical record. Anyway, in my shortish lecture, I want to say something about the fortunes of the coalition government, but my focus is going to be on the challenges that it faces in relation to Europe. And one of the things that is important about this is that the challenge that Europe poses for the coalition government, the challenges of the EU, is wholly domestically created. So the point I want to make is that the preoccupations of the current coalition government, and particularly the dominant party in that coalition government, the Conservative Party, and its concerns over Europe, has very little to do with the real consequences of current European policy and its relationship with the British government. Europe has a number of very large and pressing problems at the moment. The euro area has created an enormous number of issues that have fully preoccupied the European Union in the period that the UK coalition government has been in place. So there's very little by way of initiatives that are coming from Europe that are challenging the UK government to make concessions or to change its policy and its orientation. Similarly, the domestic agenda of the British government is the familiar agenda of all Western economies, which is austerity, deficit reduction, shrinking of the state, and so on, very little of which has any real relationship to the problems or the interrelationships that the UK government has with the European Union. So it's the electoral politics, and it's the wholly internally generated perspective on the European Union that is the issue that I want to focus on. If you read the UK press, if you read the British press, you'll see an almost constant preoccupation with the role of Europe in British politics. The current Prime Minister announced that should he be successful in winning a majority government after the 2015 election, will enter into negotiations with Europe, which will result in a referendum where the people will have a vote on whether to accept those new terms, potential new terms for our relationship with Europe, or leave. Now, why we've got into that position where the British government is even considering the prospect of a potential referendum on membership of the European Union at some stage in the future is in many ways difficult to understand, okay? Because there's nothing significant that's arisen in UK-EU relations that drives that. And it's something of that that I want to say a little bit more about. But first of all, I think it's worth saying a little bit about the history of the Conservative Party's relationship with the European project, because it's the Conservative Party's internal ideology and politics that is going to be the primary focus of what I want to say. So, as you will all know, the European Union has its roots in the post-war settlement, and in particular the 1957 Treaty of Rome. Britain was not part of that, although there were moves for Britain to be part of the initial group of six that established the European Economic Community. The Treaty of Rome was signed, as I say, in 1957, in a period when Britain had a Conservative government, and the then Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was keen that Britain should be party to that initial agreement, but was thwarted by the impact of by the influence of the French President General de Gaulle. The important point about that is that the UK Conservative Party was a pro-European party. Okay, it remained a pro-European party throughout the next decade, leading up to Edward Heath's tenure from 1970 to 1974, in which Britain finally succeeded in becoming a member of what was then the European Economic Community, EEC. And it was a Conservative Prime Minister that took Britain into what became the European Union. Conservative Prime Minister. At that time, main opposition, the Social Democratic opposition, the Labour Party in Britain, was primarily hostile to Europe, the European project. It was hostile for a whole variety of reasons, some of which was anti-Americanism, some of which was preference for British Commonwealth, some of it was because the European Economic Community was seen as a sort of Christian Democrat, conservative sort of cartel in a way, and would be hostile to the interests of the Social Democratic Party. So when Edward Heath's government fell in 1974, the Labour Party committed itself to an in-out referendum, a post-legislative referendum on whether or not Britain should stay in the European Economic Community. And there was a referendum. The turnout was relatively high by UK standards, 65%, and 17.3 million of the electors, the voters, voted yes to stay in. Yes on the question, which was, do you think the UK should stay in the European Community, common market? 17.3 million said yes, 8.5 million said no. So, the important things, Conservative Party is pro-Europe, the Labour Party was against Europe, and a significant majority of those who expressed an opinion in a referendum were in favour of the European project. Okay, this is in 1974-5. In 1979, Mrs. Thatcher comes to power and begins a period of 11 years in office. And there's a significant transformation in British political life, a significant transformation in the culture, the character of modern conservatism. Thatcherism becomes a sort of ideology in itself, an ism. It's interesting to note that in the referendum campaign in the 70s, Mrs. Thatcher campaigned for continued membership of the European Economic Community. She was sufficiently active in support of the European Economic Project. So we enter Mrs. Thatcher's term without any idea that the Conservative Party would become fundamentally hostile to the European project. But over the course of her 10 years in office, the situation changes. The Labour Party, which had been defeated significantly in 1979 and more significantly still in 1983, started to change its response, its attitude towards the European Union. In a process that culminates with Tony Blair becoming leader of the Labour Party after the 1992 election of John Major, Labour reconciles itself to the European project and becomes a significantly pro-European party. The Conservatives, on the other hand, having been the pro-European party, the main focus of sympathy for the European Union, become progressively anti-European. During Mrs. Thatcher's term, she continues to engage with the European project. She signs the Single European Act. But by the end of her term, in 1990, it's Europe that partly explains her fall from office. And her own party has clearly started to divide significantly on its attitude to the European Union. Now, there's a whole variety of reasons for why that might be the case. I won't go into those in great detail. Some of those might be to do with the character of the European project itself, that it moves from being primarily a sort of Christian Democrat, conservative, business-focused project to something that is more sympathetic to a social agenda, and therefore the Social Democrats can sign up to it. But the parties change in their attitude. That's the crucial point. And at the end of that period, that change starts to manifest itself in a much more aggressively anti-European Conservative Party under John Major, and in the subsequent years following John Major's defeat by Tony Blair in 1997. The last few years of Major's government were characterised by the rise of a group of Eurosceptics, a significant minority of backbench members of Parliament who were prepared to destroy their own government in order to take a tough stance on objecting to closer European integration. Some of those figures end up in the coalition government after 2010. But what's quite clear is that the Conservatives' turn in attitude to Europe essentially makes them unelectable. One of the key changes in the fortunes of the Labour Party following the 1992 general election and the protracted debates over the Maastricht Treaty, where John Major was held to ransom by his own party over passing this important European treaty. One of the key consequences of that is that the city and business lost confidence in the Conservative Party as a political vehicle that represented their interests, and money started to flow into the Labour Party. It's often talked about as a sort of charm offensive by Tony Blair in relation to the city, but it was the city losing confidence in the Conservative Party, its natural party, as the vehicle for pursuing its own interests. And that's quite important, I think, for the future of the Conservative Party. So, the legacy of these Euro debates is also tied, in the Conservative Party, is also tied to some score settling within the Conservative Party over the fortunes of Mrs. Thatcher. So the way in which Mrs. Thatcher fell from office, where she was deposed by her own party in 1990, gets tied into this hostility to Europe as itself a kind of social democratic project. And all of this gets woven into a new interpretation of what it is to be a conservative. So although Mrs. Thatcher's thrown out of office, although there is a 7-year conservative rule post Mrs. Thatcher, Thatcherism becomes the sort of defining characteristic of conservatism as a party stance, the test of authenticity of potential members of the party, and becomes an electoral liability. An electoral liability that sees the Conservatives out of office for the period of 1997 through till 2010. And what happens in that period? Well, one of the interesting things is that despite a series of ever more aggressively anti-European leaders, William Hague, followed by Ian Duncan Smith, followed by Michael Howard, who all got progressively more strident in their views on Europe, the electoral fortunes of the Conservative Party only got worse. After the 2005 election, Tony Blair's last election, which he still won, although with a reduced majority, but he won in the shadow of the Iraq War, where by all other measures one would have expected him to be defeated significantly, he still won the election. The Conservatives had a very, very strongly anti-European stance, and it had no good. It served them no good at all. They had no success at all in this stridently anti-European stance. So following the defeat in 2005, a new leader is chosen, David Cameron. And the first thing Cameron does is try and change the subject. So whereas conservatism has become profoundly preoccupied with Europe and the ills of the European Union, what does Cameron do? He completely changes the subject. He invents something called the Big Society. What the Big Society is, nobody really knows, but it doesn't really matter. The point about the strategy of the Big Society was really to have the party talk about something else. Almost anything else was sufficient. So a lot of commentators criticised the Big Society as being vacuous and it wasn't a strong electoral message, as opposed to never join Euro or pulling out of Europe. Cameron deliberately chose it because it wasn't a strong, clear message on anything. It was open. It's a sort of vehicle in which anything could be done, and you don't mention Europe. The other interesting thing about Cameron's early period in office is he starts to talk about issues. Maybe these are an attempt to give some content to the Big Society, but issues that are unrelated to Europe, sovereignty, the euro, and so on. Cameron turns to a social agenda that enables him to characterise himself as a liberal. He calls himself in a famous speech in 2007 a liberal conservative, qualifying his conservatism with social liberalism. And in this he picks up some ideas that are associated with a publication that came from the Liberal Party called the Orange Book, where the Liberal Party, the Liberal Democratic Party, a small third party in British politics, was also reviewing its position on the political spectrum. The Liberal Democrats were in some respects seen as the conscience of the left. They were the ones who believed in civil liberties, they were hostile to the Iraq War, they believed in the kinds of things, they were against identity cards, all the sorts of things that Tony Blair's Labour Party flirted with. The Liberals were seen as the conscience of the centre-left and being against those things. But Cameron starts to use some of the language of liberalism, saying that he too is a social liberal, an economic conservative, committed to conservative positions on the economy, but on social issues he's an enlightened figure, more comfortable with diversity and difference and so on. And the whole tone of Cameron's leadership has been to try and reposition the Conservative Party, talking about these social issues. Interestingly, Cameron, given that he is still a conservative, albeit a liberal conservative, has just driven through legislation to allow for equality of marriage rights for gay people in Britain. A profoundly liberal policy, but one that's been brought up by a conservative prime minister, doing precisely the kinds of things that conservative politicians in the past would not have been interested in: social issues, issues of personal liberty, and so on. So Cameron has pursued this strategy of changing the subject. Now that works in 2010, because the election in 2010 shifts the focus away from Europe. All the parties are broadly quiet about Europe. There's nothing to be gained by talking about Europe. And what happens at the end of this process? We have a hung parliament where no party has sufficient seats to form a government on its own, and the only viable electoral coalition is one between the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democratic Party. The numbers would be so complex for a Labour-led coalition that it would have been an unstable coalition. Now, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats are natural enemies. As I said, the Liberal Democrats are a small party, but they're usually seen as a centre-left party, and yet they form within 3 days a coalition agreement with the Conservative Party to form a government and to share office. So this is not simply to supply votes and supply to make sure the business of government continues. This is a proper coalition agreement with a programme for government. And that's done within 3 days. And everything starts off very positively. They're on the same page when they're discussing the problems, the overriding problems facing British politics of austerity, deficit reduction, and so on. And that's what they concentrate on. So the coalition continues with its one issue agenda, effectively. Austerity, deficit reduction, that's what this government is about. Everything else is irrelevant. Foreign wars, international relations of any kind, foreign policy sort of falls down the agenda. We have subsequently had a small war in Libya, but that's not the priority of the government. The government's priority is the overriding one of deficit reduction. And on that level, the coalition has been remarkably successful. Successful in the sense of being able to function, not successful in the sense of maintaining significant electoral popularity. But then any government dealing with deficit reduction and austerity would be unpopular. So unpopularity was to be expected. Instead, we have a stable coalition. But then we start to see the Europe issue reemerge. And it reemerges partly because of the domestic pressures within the Conservative Party to differentiate itself within the coalition. So the coalition, in a sense, is successful and stable, but it presents a problem for the two parties that, well, it presents different problems, but it presents problems for the two parties that are within it. For the Liberal Democrats, it presents the problem of a rapid adjustment to the demands of government. The Liberal Democrats are a very small party. They wouldn't normally expect to get office of any kind. So they are there to be a sort of conscience of other parties. No Liberal Democratic member of Parliament would seriously enter Parliament with the expectation of a full career in government, whereas in the Labour Party or in the Conservative Party, there's always the hope that with luck you might end up Chancellor or the Prime Minister. But the Liberal Democrats would never have expected that. So they have the problem of identifying the capacity to govern. The Conservatives, on the other hand, have the problem that they were unsuccessful. Unsuccessful in forming a majority government. And one of the things that does is expose pressures within the party. There's lots of people now who won't get office because those positions are taken by their coalition partners, some of them quite significant. There's the worry that if the coalition falls and there is a majority Conservative government, their generation will be passed over by new talent coming in later on. So the concern is that you get your one chance at senior office, you've missed it, that's because of the coalition, and that creates pressures on the coalition government. There's concerns that Cameron failed to deliver a majority against an unpopular Labour leader. And then finally, there's the problem of how that differentiation between the coalition parties is spoken about. How do you articulate your difference when you're in a coalition? You can't differentiate yourself on the issue of the austerity measures, the primary policy agenda of the party, because you both agree on that. And in fact, the opposition broadly agrees on it, but it differs in pace of change. So this has to be something else that's the basis for your differentiation, and that's where Europe reappears. For no other reason than the internal dynamics of Conservative Party politics within the coalition, we start to see the pressures of the party forcing the Prime Minister to take a more strident and a more tough stance on Europe, even though there are no real pressures in terms of European and UK politics to do so. So leading up to this claim that there will even be an in-out referendum in 2017 is driven by these internal, purely internal issues, rather than some great initiative that's been done elsewhere. Because the real problems preoccupying Europe, the European Union now, are to do with the euro. We're not part of the euro. So all of that is being done around us and apart from us, and we're quite happy with that. But the party's problem is also exacerbated because at the local level, the popular membership of the party, they come under pressure from another peculiar feature of British politics. And this is the UK Independence Party. Now, the UK Independence Party was founded by an LSE professor. Some of you may have come across Professor Alan Sked. Sked is in international history, but in the 1990s he established this organisation called the United Kingdom Independence Party, which was designed to campaign solely for an in-out referendum. And it's a single-issue party, and it contests a number of... It contests local, parliamentary, and certainly the European parliamentary elections, and does so rather successfully. The reason I mention Sked is because although Sked was the founder of it, he left the party after 1997, accusing it of being full of racists and the extreme right. And that tells you something quite important about the United Kingdom Independence Party. They pose a challenge to the popular membership, the paid membership of the Conservative Party, because they offer the policy that many of the backbench members of Parliament in the Conservative Party are calling for in order to challenge David Cameron's position within the coalition. But the leadership of the Conservative Party can't offer anything sufficiently robust to meet those needs, whereas the UK Independence Party is quite clear. It can say, we will pull out of Europe straight away. And they are quite successful in elections. Interestingly, in the 2009 European parliamentary elections, they won 11 of the 75 seats that are distributed on a proportional basis. And the consequence of that is that they then get the payment that goes with the significant, valuable payment that goes with being a European parliamentary member, and that allows them to build their party structure. So it provides them with a source of income they wouldn't have otherwise had. And it is curious that this party that is there to exit the European Union is partly funded by the European Union through their holding 11 seats in the European Parliament. So Cameron is caught, and the coalition is caught, between these two pressures. The pressures from his backbench members and the pressures from the UK Independence Party. And we had a recent by-election at the beginning of March, where a Liberal Democrat MP who had been forced to resign, his seat was contested, and the United Kingdom Independence Party came second, a close second in that constituency, and seemed to challenge the prospects of the Conservative Party and their ability to hold popular support sufficient to form a majority government in due course. So where is all this leading? Where is all this leading? The pressures on the coalition government, the real pressures on the coalition government are ultimately on their ability to deal with the fundamental political economy that they've inherited. But the character of British politics at the moment would suggest that the primary issue facing the coalition government is its relationship with Europe. And its relationship with Europe in such a way that leads to whether or not there should be a referendum on leaving. What can Cameron do about that? What can the coalition do about that? Let me conclude with a number of speculative judgments, a number of possible predictions about what might happen. But first, let me also perhaps say why this might be of more interest than just reporting to you the internal politics of a rather small country quite a long way away around the world. And the UK is still quite important. You know, it's the depending on how you measure it, it has the seventh largest economy by purchasing power parity, the sixth by nominal gross domestic product. It's the second largest economy in Europe. Europe is the largest single trading bloc. UK matters in that sense. Okay, we're small, we were once greater, we have more colour on the map than we do now, but we're still significant. So the internal dynamics of British politics should be of a little bit of interest to the rest of the world. In a way that's parallel, I think, to the way in which external observers look at the travails of the US Republican Party. Okay, it's local, but in a way, if you're seeing a party unravel because it's got its ideology out of line with its political and economic interests, then that's interesting in itself. But the second issue, I think, is also that we are starting to see the progressive decline of one of the two main parties of a two-party electoral system. We're seeing the fragmentation of the British party in the British electoral system, and part of that is through the decline of the Conservative Party as an electoral force. So one of the issues that follows from this is whether or not the Conservative Party can regain that position as a successful campaigning political vehicle. And here, I think the parallels with the situation of the US Republican Party are very interesting. What we see with the Conservative Party is its choice of ideological orientation to differentiate itself from other parties, being detached from other elements of a successful political party, interests and the long-term character and expectations of the electorate. They're out of line with the electorate in terms of the priorities that the electorate has, and their ideology is becoming increasingly out of line with the expectations and the interests of the electorate. So that leads us to two things. One, there's the risk again that should we ever move towards an in-out referendum, financial support, business support will shift from the Conservative Party. There isn't a significant voice at the moment, but it's there. And if it comes to a choice between choosing engagement with Europe, the city has a very strong interest in maintaining that, they will support any party that is pro-membership of the European Union and shift from the Conservative Party. The other thing is the problem that's posed by the United Kingdom Independence Party, because although they're a single issue party, when you drill down into the polling data and you ask people who vote for the UK Independence Party what's the most important issue for you, they don't say leaving the European Union, they say immigration. The European Union, in a sense, is a sort of headline, is of headline significance in terms of the coverage of debates in Britain, but it's not a priority for the majority of British people. People don't like the European Union, but they don't like it in the same way that people don't like government of any kind. The UK Independence Party is a kind of populist, anti-government party that's against the European Union because it tells us what to do, but it's also an anti-political party in the way that you see emerging with these oppositional anti-politics movements in Italy and other parts of Europe. They don't really have a policy agenda, And when you ask most people what their electoral priorities are, European Union is way down the list, about 7th out of 10, along with fox hunting and the funding of universities. So if you ask them in a poll, what do you think about Europe in or out, they'll give you one answer. When they make an election for when they make a choice for a government in a general election, it's a very different set of priorities. So the problem for the Conservative government is that it's been pushed to follow an agenda which will only lead it to less and less electoral success. So my final prediction then is that, or predictions is that, European partners will not do enough, will not be able to do enough to appease the Euroscepticism of the Conservative Party. So no negotiations between Britain and Europe will do anything to solve the problems that Cameron's government faces. UKIP will not be able to win enough votes to form a government to put its policy into place. All it can do is damage the other parties by maintaining this populist anti-government stance. And nothing the Conservative Party can do can solve the concerns that people have about immigration. Immigration is one of those things that people have a fear of, and whatever you do, they still have more fear of it. There's no real policy agenda that can deal with this. And finally, that until the Conservative Party finds some way of accommodating its concerns of Europe, and in this week when Mrs. Thatcher has died, shedding the legacy of Thatcher's scepticism, moving on, until it can do that, it is in the process of long-term decline and is unlikely to form a majority government any time in the future. So the fortunes of the Conservative Party, the fortunes of the British electoral system, in a sense, are being shaped by this issue about Europe in the coalition. So my prediction is that there will not be a Conservative government until they return to some equilibrium view on their relationships with Europe. So, thank you. So, we have some time for questions, and I have a brief replenishment of my drink. Is there a microphone, or do? Okay. So, who would like to challenge me? Raise a question or make some observations or support my or amend and develop my argument. Anyway, please feel free or anything general on British politics.
Actually, I'm interested in Cameron's big society. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering, is that a concept or a real practice? Does that mean if the government refused to put money to social enterprises, the commercial organization. What's your opinion?
Well, that's a very good question, because when the whole big society agenda was developed, a lot of people expected it to have concrete answers to those kinds of questions. Where would state provision end? Who would take up when the state withdraws provision of various kinds of things? And there isn't a simple answer to that. I genuinely believe, I think I've got pretty good reason for that, that the task of the big society was this more abstract and general point about changing the agenda. But at the same time, the big society brings together a lot of elements that were already within conservatism in various ways, about self-reliance, about the importance of civil society organizations, about the state retreating from some of its obligations under the welfare state. Where does it draw the line? It's hard to tell. Cameron, and the Cameron government has been, particularly on things like education, has been open to academy schools, so parents or other organizations establishing and taking responsibility for running schools, including the financing of schools. So that could be one element of this. But on the other hand, the some of the other policies that are pursued by the government seem to challenge the primary vehicles through which these this taking up of responsibility would work, which is still churches in Britain. the Church of England is still, I mean, the numbers who attend regular services are declining, but it's still wealthy and powerful. The Catholic Church still has a stake in the public education system, part funding the schools that it has under the education system. So that would be one of the obvious places, one would think, for the big society agenda to develop, you know, the charitable side of these organisations taking up responsibility for some aspects of health and welfare and education. But that doesn't seem to be a clearly worked out agenda. It doesn't seem to be clearly worked out, and the incentives are not there. And some of the things Cameron has done have deliberately antagonised, particularly, say, the social reforms on gay marriage, has antagonised some of these organisations and made them less willing to engage with the coalition government to give content to what the big society might be. But it's there to be filled with policy ideas, but those aren't forthcoming because there's no money to be spent, and there needs to be money to make those changes, and the primary task is deficit reduction. That's all that government is concerned with. Hello, Harry.
Yeah.
Yes.
And my question is, does the U.S. place the role, does the American, if place a role in the European Union, as we have present people fear that Britain might be an American plot?
Yeah. That's right.
After 5 years.
Yes. Well, many of those early conservative advocates of entry to the European Union were concerned with precisely that, providing the cultural bridge between the United States and Europe, making sure that the United States' interests didn't depart from the interests of Europe completely. So it was part of tying together Europe and the US during the late Cold War period, rather than seeing a kind of global conflict being fought out in European terrain. But the current Eurosceptic wing of the Conservative Party has taken a rather different view about Anglo-US relations, and has shifted, has argued for a shift of attention away from Europe towards the United States, an Atlantic model in opposition to. So it's almost, for some of the more vociferous anti-European politicians in the Conservative ranks or in the European Parliament under the Conservative whip, it's almost as if they would like to leave Europe and join the United States, people like Daniel Hannan and so on. Now, why that's interesting, of course, is recently we had the very, very rare direct intervention of the United States government under Obama, allowing a junior figure, but nevertheless allowing a junior figure to express the view that the United States' interest was to see Europe, the UK remain part and centrally engaged with the European Union. So this was a direct shot from the United States across the bows of the Eurosceptic wing of the Conservative Party. Now, whether that was supposed to help Cameron or to create more problems, it certainly didn't help him in the short run, I think is an interesting question. But all evidence suggests that certainly the current US regime would see the United States' interests as best served by the UK being closely engaged with the EU. And in that sense, that also changes these internal calculations about where Britain's true interests reside. But I think my primary point is that the debates that characterise British politics in relation to Europe have no real bearing on where Britain's national interests really reside. It's quite clear that they are with European integration. Maybe not membership of the Euro, but nevertheless, they are with Europe. That's seen by many outsiders. The Germans regard that as being our interest. It's in their interest that we're part of Europe as well. So at that level, there shouldn't be a problem. But nevertheless, in terms of the domestic politics of Britain, it's almost as if the European Union is our biggest problem, and it clearly isn't. So when one comes away and looks in from the perspective of international relations and international politics, you're quite right, it's very, very different. And the pressures are on integration, not separation. He didn't have to make himself unelectable. One of the interesting things about the United Kingdom Independence Party is it will take votes from all of the parties, and it will take them in different places. So the electoral geography of Britain will mean, here's another prediction, that the next government will be a coalition government, but it will not be a Conservative Liberal coalition government. I would be surprised if Miliband, and it's not simply because of the personality, but I would be surprised if the British Labour Party were able to form a majority government. The electoral logic is moving away, and one of the consequences of party de-alignment, in a way, voters sort of breaking the strong traditions of association with the party, is they don't go back. They don't all go back. And the projections for a large Labour majority depend on voters moving back to the Labour Party. There's no evidence that they're going to do that. Some will. Certainly some voters who joined the Liberal Democrats will go back to... but some will go to an anti-Europe party like the United Kingdom Independence Party. Interestingly, there is evidence from the electoral returns that in some places Liberal Democrat voters... And they're a pro-European, civil libertarian, centrist, sometimes left-centre party, will vote for United Kingdom Independence Party. Why on earth does that happen? Well, sometimes it's a protest. It's the candidate is wrong, Labour has a bad candidate, or the Conservatives have a bad candidate, or the Liberal Democrat candidate is a bad candidate. So people do odd things once you break the basic ties. And my sense is that what will happen with the current distribution of votes will not be sufficient to give the Labour Party a majority. Their legacy had changed under successive leaders in the 1980s. Blair managed to with some fairly clever politicking achieve large electoral landslides with progressively diminishing proportions of the vote, but that's unlikely to continue. So I think coalitions are going to be increasingly common in Britain, and particularly so if the Conservatives are unable to sort of sort out their problems with Europe. So Conservatives have a problem, but it's not only the Conservative Party. This is not something to celebrate. Except for one thing, which is completely unrelated, but again an internal issue. If the you may know that there is also in Scotland an independence movement, a nationalist party that is the government of the in the National Assembly, the Scottish Parliament, and they're moving towards a referendum about membership of the United Kingdom. Now, they won't win that referendum. They might come close, but they won't win. If they come very, very close, but don't win, it wouldn't be inconceivable for a Conservative government to make concessions to the Scottish Parliament to give them ever greater powers, but within the Union, remaining within the Union, in return for reduced representation in Parliament. Which would be the logic of that. Now, if that happens, the party that's most significantly affected by the reduction in Scottish seats is the Labour Party, where its dominant share is. That would change the electoral politics. Now, there is precedent for this. Think of how Northern Ireland worked within the Union. Okay, completely separate parliament until the 1960s, direct rule, and then a new settlement under the Government of Ireland Act and the peace agreements and so on. It would be quite possible to retain the integrity of the Union and have greater autonomy for Scotland. And Scotland would probably accept that, because it's unclear that the majority of people really want direct independence. And on some of the key issues that are central to independence, such as controlling your monetary policy and so on, they've already conceded that would still be done by the Bank of England. So, you know, what would sovereignty mean in the sense that, you know, your primary economic levers of power were exercised by the country that you've apparently left? It would be mad. So that might be a different scenario. One of this.
Yes. I have to admit that I didn't know a lot about. I'm not very familiar with domestic politics in the UK, and I find it very fascinating to see how different domestic policy issues are in our different European countries.
Yeah.
But they're all things that are in crises. It seems like it.
Yeah.
On a different level, they all
yeah.
face some level of crisis. And then I think in the next step, it's a very interesting setting. Sitting here, at the roots of Beijing to this. To discuss the issues of European politics. And so I wonder, looking at all these different domestic crises you have in Europe, what do you answer to somebody who says, well, see, this democracy is not really working? be that person Chinese or European, I don't know.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
Because there's also voices in Europe
yeah.
who say, well, look at the crisis, just can't get things done.
Well, that's a very good question. And I mean, I think the rise of these anti-politics parties, protest parties, of which the UK Independence Party is one, although it's focused on Europe as the main enemy, although these are parties within a democratic system, if you push the members or the voters, you know, as to what they're really interested in, I mean, these are the sort of people who want strong government, or the right kind of government, strongly given. These are the people who admired the sort of smack of foam government that they had from a leader like Mrs. Thatcher. What's wrong with our politics in the West is that we have all of this debate and coalition and, you know, trying to agree stuff. What we need is leadership. And of course, once you go down that road, then leadership versus democracy, it's a very familiar European tradition. You know, democracy has only really been the European model of government since 1945, and a lot of that was imposed on countries against their will by occupying armies. You think of the precarious position of the Weimar government, you know, that was almost a kind of alien imposition to many Germans. Strong leadership, well, now democracy is the norm, but France was the same, Italy was the same, many Catholic countries too had a very precarious appreciation of the value of democracy. The idea that the West has been democratic since Athens in 2400 BC and everybody else just hasn't noticed is not true. So maintaining democratic politics is a very difficult thing, and the challenges to democratic politics from within democracy, as the European tradition, European 20th century history shows, is also deeply problematic. The challenges are there. So yes, we need to be mindful of that when we look at what happens in other countries and other traditions. But the other interesting thing about that is that, you know, people who have the vote, when they're allowed to not vote, generally don't. The turnout in European elections in Britain is usually below 30%. General election turnout is on the decline from relatively high levels, but pushing, you know, 50%, people don't seem to be too bothered about being asked who their government is. But if you took the vote away, it would be a very different matter altogether. So when you have democracy, you're more likely to think, you know, what matters is good government, good government is the key issue all the time. But good government and democracy don't always go together, but they're not mutually antagonistic either. And I think that's the primary answer. You know, there's no real regime that guarantees you good government all the time. That's why you have to have some mechanism for regime change or elite reselection or something. And even single party states find they have to do that. There has to be some way of renewal of your governing elite, your executive, whether you do that in a staged way. Politics reappears all the time. Some of that, yeah.
So, thank you. Talking about history, Mrs. Thatcher was talking about she's defending 2,000 years Britishness. And she's, I think before she resigned from the government, about huge issue is foreign exchange.
Mm.
British pounds versus
Deutsche
Mark.
Yeah.
She mentioned, I'm not going to allow somebody else to decide the value of the pounds. So my question is this, in the future, at the moment, considering about the past, with euro, integration, half mind integration, who is making the value, who is deciding the value of the British pound in the future? American or Euro?
Well, that's a complex technical question, but I'm not sure the British decide the value of the British pound anyway. You know, it is a tradable currency, and we have to live with that. I think when you sort of recognise that, the idea that somehow or other this is having your own currency is essential. Well, it depends what your currency is. Certainly, if you're going to have genuine economic integration and build a proper currency union, then certain things have to happen, which we know the architects of the euro knew weren't the case, but still went ahead with the policy. The question is whether or not there will be, over time, the requisite convergence so that there's legitimacy in monetary policy and fiscal policy being decided outside of national parliaments. But it's hard to know. Currency unions do work. It took a long time for the United States to establish a national currency. It took even longer for it to establish a central bank. It has one. The dollar is now unproblematic. You know, we've had the euro for, 13 years? It's in difficulty now. Too much is invested in it going away. It may turn into the Deutschmark by another name, but it's quite clear that the Germans don't want it to fail, and they won't let it fail. And in the long run, it's also in the British interest that it doesn't. So, you know, the answer to your question is, there isn't a simple answer to your question, but it raises a number of really important issues which are completely untouched by this. But economic nationalism is an interesting issue because, as I say, with the Scottish nationalists talking about national independence and sovereignty, you know, the one thing they're happy to trade is control over the currency, which one would say is, you know, it's crucial if you are going to be, you know, genuinely independent in this sort of utopian ideal sense of what sovereignty is. And it isn't that they're going to cede economic sovereignty to the European Union. They're going to leave it with the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, on which they have no representation. I mean, that's just like the status of the most lowly Commonwealth member, you know, 50, 60 years ago. You're right. I mean, the scale of immigration and the impacts of immigration in Britain are notable. If you look at the recent census, the number of people living in London who were not born in London or the UK has gone up significantly, and the source of those countries is also interesting. But immigration doesn't impact on the United Kingdom uniformly. It's concentrated in one or two big cities, and it's hugely concentrated in London. So lots of people who raise the issue of immigration never come across immigration at all, but they're worried about it. And they're worried about it for reasons that are easily addressed. You know, they're worried that foreigners come in and take all the jobs, as if there's a finite number of jobs, and if too many clever Chinese come and take them, there won't be any jobs left, rather than, you know, economies are dynamic and they create more work and so on and so forth. And part of the reason we have immigration is because of skills shortages in certain areas to do with our education system and all the rest of it. But you're quite right, the debate is primarily about this. It's about, you know, Romania and Bulgaria are two very, very important, you know, challenges now. As if all of Romania and Bulgaria are going to move to London, which they're not. There is free movement to an extent within Europe, but Britain is not part of the Schengen Agreement, so there isn't complete free movement in the European Union, and therefore coming to the UK and settling is more complex. We do have immigration from other places, so some of the worry about immigration in the United Kingdom has nothing to do with the European Union. It's the legacy of coloured immigration from former British colonies being re-described in a respectable way. So racist sentiments are acceptable if you're talking about the problem of immigration, but if you're talking about Indian or Afro-Caribbean settlement, that's problematic. So you can re-describe your prejudice in an acceptable way by talking about immigration, because most people sitting on the bus wouldn't know a Pole from an English person unless the Pole was actually speaking Polish. I mean, they, you know, they look broadly like us, and many of them speak quite good English too. So why immigration is an issue is a very complex question. It brings together a number of worries about pace of social change, and it's an easy way of putting your fears about the pace of social change, urbanization, the transformation of work and all the rest of it under a simple heading. But those issues are actually much more complex than simply immigration and wouldn't be addressed simply by restricting immigration, if one could even do that. But you're right, I mean, there is something there, but I think it's more complex than control of population flows. And when we start to try and deal with population movement, we do stupid things which then undermine our competitiveness as an economy. So we say, we've got to reduce immigration. How do we do that quickly? Well, we'll stop student visas or something. We'll make it difficult for Chinese students to come and study in Britain. You know, the LSE needs students to study. That's our business. You know, we need people like you to keep coming and keep wanting to study at the LSE. If the government makes that difficult, you'll go somewhere else, and the LSE will suffer, because lots of other people will say, we would like you to come. So, you know, immigration is hugely problematic because it often leads to a misdiagnosis of the real social problems, and it leads to policy measures which have no real value and are often contrary to the national interest as well. So we lobby very hard with a government to relax its visa regulations on students, most of whom don't want to settle permanently in the United Kingdom anyway. They are like you, come and study, maybe work for a time, and then go somewhere else in a globalised economy. And I think the government, the core of the government, actually knows that. But it's very difficult for them to speak to that because of the debates that surround political life. When you talk to government ministers off the record, they are quite aware that their immigration policy is contrary to their genuine interests in growing the economy, in advancing the higher education system in Britain, which is one of the things we do quite well, and so on. They know that, and yet their policies are still this strident hostility to foreigners taking jobs, student places, and so on.